Thank you all for coming. This is what Milton would call fit audience, though few. It's the fitness that is important. I am going to read the script for that Sunstone has provided. Congratulations for surviving your first day at Sunstone. We are excited to open up our Friday sessions. Today, we invite you to reflect on the diversity that exists in this space today. All of those in attendance today are brought together through various paths in the restoration movement. As you move through your day, feel free to reach out to a stranger, make friends with someone new, and let yourselves be challenged. Before we begin, we ask that cell phones are turned off, that those attending will be respectful and attentive. It is the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue. Please keep that in mind when engaging in the question and answer portion of this session, following the remarks of the presenters. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. This session is 60 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow for the next session to start on time. As courtesy to other presenters and our attendees, we ask that immediately after this session, you clear the room and speak outside so other presenters can begin preparation for the next session. And about this session, Latter-day Saint painter John McNaughton, who promotes himself as America's artist, continues to produce paintings that are reminiscent of the propagandistic art of totalitarian regimes. For all the color McNaughton uses in his paintings, the vision of the world he presents is starkly black and white. Obama, Democrats, liberals, and progressives are all shown as being on the side of Satan, while Trump, Republicans, the founding fathers, and the common man and woman are triumphantly on the side of God, angels, and McNaughton himself. McNaughton's art, which he claims is inspired by the Holy Ghost, seems more beholden to Fox News. McNaughton's work isn't simply bad art. Like all propaganda, it is dangerous. So today this presentation will include three people, myself, Laura Hurtado. Laura Hurtado, who is a very prominent art critic and curator, who worked for the Church Museum. He was formerly art director, curator for the Church History Museum, and is currently executive director of the Utah Museum of Contemporary Art. And Dr. Thomas Rogers, who is going to be a commentator as well, is a distinguished professor, a humanitarian, scholar, and just all-around great person. I gave a presentation last night at Thursday's session on radiant Mormonism and interviewed a couple of people who exemplify that. Tom Rogers exemplifies radiant Mormonism as well as anybody in our church and our community. I'm very grateful to have him as a friend and colleague. Before I begin, Tom wants to say a few words about me, but I've limited him to 20 minutes. You can pull that. Why don't you use that?
Just
microphone.
Use this, okay?
Should be.
Yeah.
Is it live?
Well, essentially, Bob has also introduced
is that
you,
Laura.
What?
Closer to your mouth.
Oh, okay. Essentially, I'm. It's okay. Thanks. Bob has introduced Laura to us, and I'm very eager to hear more from her as well. Bob Rees is unmatched as an LDS polyglot and Mormon scholar. He was one of the very first editors of Dialogue. He's now in the process of editing the second volume of the presentations made here over the decades now, Why We Stay. He's a marvelous poet and essayist. He could, if he hasn't already published volumes of his wonderful essays about Mormon theology and life. He is now a visiting professor and has been for some time, and the in charge of Mormon studies at the Theological Union of UC Berkeley. And I know I'm leaving out a lot. He has fulfilled the mandate we were given 2 years ago, all of us as members of the church, to be ministers. He was doing that years and years ago. He was the bishop of the singles, adult singles ward in Los Angeles at the time of the first AIDS epidemic. He mentored LGBTQ members of the church, and a number of whom even took their own lives. And he has been their champion ever since. He and others have also founded the Liahona. It's now called the Bountiful Children's Project, going all over the world to third world countries and determining the need for not only member children but others for nutritional supplements who are so terribly malnourished. And he has himself gone to measure them, their height, their weight, and make that determination, and then come back and solicit funding from the stakes here in behalf of those people, those members, and even encouraging and getting the support of stakes who have adopted some of these communities. Imagine, I've just touched the surface of his great contribution. I think maybe I'll leave it at that.
You can see why I invited Tom to participate in this session. So the way we will do, I will make a presentation. I'll turn the time over to Laura Hurtado, who will comment from the point of view of an art historian and critic. Tom, with whom I was privileged to associate when I was in the mission presidency of the Baltic States Mission, and he was the mission president of the St. Petersburg, Russia Mission. And I remember a delightful evening when Tom took my daughter and my son-in-law and me to the ballet. If you're going to go to ballet, do it in St. Petersburg. But Tom's going to make some comments about propaganda, because Tom is a wonderful painter himself and had a great opportunity to observe Soviet propaganda during the time that his various trips to the Soviet Union. So Tom, if you want to sit in a more comfortable chair, I'll begin. And So 7 years ago, in an article in Sunstone, I identified what I considered the problem with John McNaughton's paintings. They tend to be rendered not in the service of art, but rather of politics, not of aesthetics, but of propaganda, in the negative sense of that word. What I wrote was this: what McNaughton's didacticism, his penchant for literalism, does, therefore, is to commandeer our imaginations, to shackle our interpretive faculties from the open possibilities of the painting, and to put our cognitive process on the Procrustean bed of his own private interpretation, leaving us no room to come to his art on our own. In other words, he does not trust us to make up our own minds or know our own hearts. The primary focus of McNaughton's paintings, which I discussed in that article, was to promote an anti-Obama, anti-democratic party, anti-liberal progressive narrative. In a series of paintings, he illustrated a United States in thrall or under siege from liberal politics to such an extent that McNaughton felt he needed to call America to repentance. Here is a quick overview. Well, here's supposed to there. And why is it not showing up there? Well, that's not working either. Oh, no, that's not working. Someone needs to get somebody who's a technologist because this doesn't work very well without... Pardon? It may be that we need to access this again.
It's because you don't have it in presentation mode.
Oh, Laura knows what she's doing. I got here early and got this already. Had two technicians in here. There we go.
Yeah, just use the arrows.
Will this work?
No, don't use that. Just use the arrows.
So these are the paintings that I mentioned. I don't know. Would it be better to turn the light off back there? Would that help my assistant, Dr. Clifton Jolly, will serve us well? There we go. That we can see that much better. I probably won't be able to see my text, but don't worry about that. These paintings are the ones that... no, this is not what I wanted. Yes, okay. So this one shows Obama standing over a totally declining America. This is another shown of Obama burning the Constitution. Obama playing golf while McNaughton, by the way, talks about McNaughton talks about Obama playing golf, listing the number of rounds of golf that he played in his 8 years, forgetting to tell us that Trump has played four times as much in his 2.5 years. This is Obama again with the America in chains, and liberals all adrift on an island, quarantined with all of the darkness that he sees in this. And this begins the presentation of McNaughton's paintings that I'm going to be talking about. At the end of my article, I told of McNaughton's plan to go into seclusion, quote-unquote, to wake up America. He said, I want this painting to create, let's see, that was this one, the one you just saw before, the one that shows Obama and the America in chains. He says, I want this painting to create a shocking visual truth of what is happening in our country and hopefully wake up America to what's at stake. That is, McNaughton sees himself more as a watchman on the tower, a sort of modern-day Jeremiah sent to warn the nation that as someone who expresses his dreams and visions of and around the world. As I wrote in that article, it's hard to think of any legitimate artist in the long history of Western art with such a blatant political agenda. The paintings McNaughton has completed, leading up to and continuing to the present of the Trump administration, confirm my original judgment, not only that McNaughton is more propagandist than painter, but that he is more interested in agitprop than in art. In other words, McNaughton seems more inspired by right-wing political agenda than by some internal light or fire. By this, I don't mean that he isn't passionate about his politics, but rather that he is so rigidly and blindly so. And I suspect too blinded by his own fame and success to see its negative impact. This can be seen on his website, where he has crowned himself as America's artist. Based on the major works he has completed during the Trump administration, I think it is more accurate to think of him as Trump's and Fox News' artist. Let me illustrate what I mean. One of McNaughton's favorite tropes is the, quote, forgotten man, a figure found in a number of his paintings. In my previous article, I observed that McNaughton's MacNaughton plagiarized this figure from Maynard Dixon's paintings, also titled Forgotten Man, hanging in the BYU Museum of Art at the university where MacNaughton earned his BFA. I also observed the irony of MacNaughton using Dixon's image, since Dixon's paintings, quote, rendered in the 1930s and 1940s, reflect socialist and New Deal ideology to which MacNaughton is vehemently opposed. The ascension of Donald Trump to the American presidency has inspired MacNaughton to paint even more than he did of the Obama presidency. However, whereas MacNaughton was intent on demonizing Obama, his portrayals of Trump are just the opposite. In fact, one could call them hagiographic, since they portray Trump as heroic and triumphant. This can be seen in a number of his paintings that I'll be talking about today, in which MacNaughton identifies or associates Trump with Christ. One of MacNaughton's newest paintings, Forgotten Man paintings, is Teaching a Man to Fish, which should go back to here. Teaching a Man to Fish, which shows Trump as a fisherman. Since the primitive church, the fish has been a symbol of the Savior, related not only to the fish in the archetypal symbol of, as an archetypal symbol of birth and rebirth, but also to Jesus choosing fishermen as his disciples, and in calling them to be fishers of men and women. MacNaughton, who displays no evidence either in his paintings or in his quote-unquote explanations of them, that he understands anything about irony, seems unaware that Trump has likely never held a fishing pole in his life and couldn't tell a dry fly from a streamer fly, let alone a gold-ribbed hare's ear from a pheasant-tailed nymph. All that seems important is to keep the kid distracted from those dangerous books. The irony is compounded by the fact that Trump shows no evidence of having ever read a book, including the Bible and the books supposedly written by him. It is further compounded by MacNaughton's ignorance of or indifference to the fact that Trump's education policies have undercut and eroded American education each year of his presidency. As a report in The Guardian observes, the Trump administration is waging a quiet war on education. The Center for American Progress calls Trump's education policy disastrous. Another MacNaughton painting associating Trump with Christ is one called Drain the Swamp, which is deliberately an imitation of Emanuel Lutz's famous Washington Crossing the Delaware. In regard to this painting, MacNaughton explains everything, which he always does. Trump endeavors to cross the swamp of Washington, D.C. as he carries the light of truth, hope, and prosperity. The murky water of the deep state is laced with dangerous vermin, perfectly willing to destroy American prosperity for their personal ideologies and financial gain. The establishment Democrats, never Trumper Republicans, deep state, and fake news media will do all they can to stop the majority of American people from succeeding. So if you go to his website, you will see MacNaughton as he produces videos of him explaining everything about this. It's comments like this and it's paintings like this that make MacNaughton's paintings so easy to satirize. There we go. It would be fun to take time to look at all of these figures, but one can go on the internet and find lots of examples of parody of MacNaughton's work. But note how in his comments, MacNaughton alludes to the famous trope of Christ holding the lantern found in popular Christian art. So you have Trump holding the lantern, crossing the Delaware, and MacNaughton is deliberately echoing the images of Christ holding the lantern. But also notice how differently his triad is of truth, hope, and prosperity from Paul's faith, hope, and love. That is, prosperity is one of McNaughton's most famous words, and we can presume that with the great tax cut that McNaughton has done very well indeed. Such rhetoric makes McNaughton more akin to a Fox News commentator than an artist. In fact, McNaughton is a darling of Fox News. As Monica Hesse observes in her Washington Post article, McNaughton is a repeat guest on Fox and Friends. Sean Hannity owns several originals, including $300,000 original of Forgotten Man. Another painting in the You're Not Forgotten series shows Trump crushing the serpent's head, which echoes not only the image of Obama stepping on the Constitution from a previous painting, but alludes to the familiar Christian identification of Jesus crushing the serpent's head. As one commentator asserts, Jesus came to crush the serpent's head. Jesus bruised the serpent's head on Calvary, and therefore McNaughton's use of it and this identical title, that is, he calls this his Forgotten Man series, but he also has another painting, which is the one I just showed you, which is called You Are Not Forgotten. Trump also has painted this, which he gives the exact same title to, You Are Not Forgotten. Another painting associating Trump with Jesus is his Make America Safe Again, showing Trump unlocking the gate to a sort of bucolic paradise preserved for the right and the righteous, or the righteous right. As McNaughton observes, President Trump holds the key to American prosperity for now and future generations. As the sun sets on a former time of mindless liberal policies that will make America unsafe and unprosperous, here there's that word, let us raise the wall and lock the gate to all who wish to come uninvited. Note the not-so-veiled allusion to immigrants who, in McNaughton's and Trump's world, are not worthy to be allowed past the gatekeeper. McNaughton surely was aware when painting Trump as the trope of Jesus at the gate, which also we see and we are familiar with. So McNaughton's identification of Trump with Christ is not subtle, considering John 10:9, in which Jesus says, I am the gate. Whoever enters through me will be saved. They will come in and go out and find pasture. In Trump's and McNaughton's world, they find prosperity rather than pasture. Also, according to Isaiah, Jesus holds the keys of the kingdom. Then will I set the key to the house of David on his shoulder. And the New Testament, Jesus gives the keys to his disciples, so that McNaughton, alluding to Trump holding the keys and unlocking the gate to let the righteous in, but to keep the unrighteous out, as he explains, as the sun sets on the former time, as I mentioned, that let us raise the wall and lock the gate to all who wish to come uninvited. Ah, yes, that wall. Never mind that as the gatekeeper, Jesus allows people to go in and go out, whereas Trump wants to keep people, especially those from those S-hole Middle Eastern and other countries south of the border, to stay out or to go back there. A final example of McNaughton's associating Trump with Christ is his newest painting, The Resistance, which is a deliberate imitation of Goya's famous painting, The 3rd of May, 1808. McNaughton's central character, shown wearing a MAGA hat, is obviously intended to show Trump as a Christ figure. As one source says of Goya's figure, the central figure of the painting, who is clearly a poor laborer, takes his place of the crucified Christ. He is sacrificing himself for the good of his nation. The lantern that sits between him and the firing squad is the only source of light in the painting. And there, again, that was in Goya's painting, an allusion to Christ. And dazzlingly illuminates his body, bathing him in what can be perceived as spiritual light. McNaughton, however, shows the light as coming from a burning U.S. flag, clearly a sacred symbol for the president, given his offense at any hint of any desecration or respect to it. In Goya's painting, the figure's expressive face, which shows an emotion of anguish that is more sad than terrified, echoes Christ's prayer on the cross, "Forgive them, Father, they know not what they do." Close inspection of the victim's right hand also shows stigmata, referencing the marks made on Christ's body during the crucifixion. But McNaughton's commentary on his painting reveals his intention. The election of Donald Trump was a catastrophe for the progressive America, but they quickly responded by organizing a myriad of leftist groups to resist President Trump. In addition to the Washington and media establishment's attack against the president, it included a large protest of violent acts against Trump supporters. End of quote. Thus, McNaughton shows Trump and Trump supporters as victims, which is the role the president plays often and easily. In my view, McNaughton's, quote, patriotic and Americana paintings should be considered blatant propaganda, a label that causes McNaughton to bristle, because in an interview, he argues, that word propaganda brings up images of Nazi Germany and Chairman Mao. The differences between that kind of art and what I do is I'm a citizen. I paint what I want. I'm not being hired by the state to prop up certain ideas. This is my personal feelings. I won't correct the grammar. How I feel about this, he says. Artists throughout history have always used their art as a way to reflect and articulate what's going on in their culture, and this just happens to be my way of doing it. So much for those art history courses at BYU. In a self-conducted interview about the Abomination painting we saw earlier, McNaughton asked himself whether his painting is propaganda. His answer, it seems funny that when a liberal artist paints a political motif, it's called artistic expression. But when a conservative does it, same thing, critics call it propaganda. When I think of propaganda, I think of early 20th century war posters commissioned by the Nazis and communist regimes. It usually conveys a negative meaning, so I know why my critics like to use it to describe me, but I'm not the government. I'm simply one individual, a citizen of this country, using my First Amendment rights to speak out through my art. McNaughton doesn't seem to understand that it is his moral judgment, not his First Amendment rights, that is in question. McNaughton's definition of propaganda is both narrow and self-serving. In the interest of time, to make sure we have time for other commentators, I'm going to move forward a little bit in this, getting past the etymological origins of propaganda. And I say, I consider what McNaughton does is dangerous. His art is in the service of a president who seems to have no moral center, one whom former Massachusetts Governor William Weld has labeled a malignant narcissist. There's nothing in McNaughton's paintings that gives even a hint of Trump's dark side, his habitual lies. According to the Washington Post, he's made more than 10,000 false or misleading claims since becoming president, or his abuse of women, 17 of whom have credibly accused him of sexual assault, his nearly total lack of empathy, his dishonesty, manipulating tax laws to avoid paying his share of taxes, cheating business partners and employees, his breaking of the law. One could go on and on. This is not an exhausting list by any means. I can't think of an American president who has had such a persistent, enthusiastic, and sycophantic artist as Trump enjoys in McNaughton. He seems the perfect mouthpiece for the president and the Republican Party, graphically and verbally. And like so many associated with Trump, he seems to be prospering financially, as I have mentioned before. As with my previous discussion of McNaughton's art, I can't help but address the matter of aesthetics, which is connected with both ethical and moral issues. McNaughton insists that he is not a propagandist, and yet I see little, if any, difference between his art and that which I saw in communist China in the 80s or in the former Soviet Union in the 80s and 90s. That McNaughton does not belong to a totalitarian artist group, nor is paid by the state, seems to me academic. His art serves a political patron, who is Trump, a media outlet, Fox News, a political theology, right-wing politics, and a political party, Republicans. That is, McNaughton plays, if not panders, to an idealistic group patron, those who identify passionately, if not blindly, with Trump, and who purchase McNaughton's paintings for their political message, assurance, and resonance. That is his right, of course, but as long as one does not confuse what he does with fine art, which he labels, that's the term that he uses on his website, John McNaughton, fine artist. I think it is important to make a distinction between McNaughton's art and that produced by other Mormon artists like Minerva Tyshirt, C.A. Christensen, Trevor Southey, and others, none of whose names is identified with a particular politician, political party, political ideology, or movement. The other distinction that I consider determinative when it comes to art is that none of these artists makes art that is so transparent, so didactic as McNaughton's, nor do they take pains to tell or spell out everything or much of anything about their art. It is McNaughton's insistence on telling us what his paintings mean, his insistence on interpreting their image and symbols, on drawing lines between every element of his paintings and their object in the political and social sphere that I find so off-putting. Let me just quickly then go to the conclusion here. I talk about the fact that McNaughton, on his website, he's got a magnifying glass that you can bring to every part of his painting so you can see it in a large type. So I say that he belabors the obvious, bashing the viewer over the head with its quote-unquote meaning. To adapt William Faulkner's Nobel acceptance speech, artists like McNaughton, quote, have forgotten the problems of the human heart in conflict with itself, which alone can make good art, because only that is worth painting, worth the agony and the sweat. The artist should leave no room in his workshop for anything but the old verities and truths of the heart, the old universal truths lacking which any work of art is ephemeral and doomed. Love and honor and pity and pride and compassion and sacrifice, of which I find none in McNaughton's painting. What to make of all of this? Because I consider the Trump presidency an existential threat to our republic, as well as religion in general, and my own religion in particular, and because I see the ways in which he has eroded and threatens further to erode the fundamental values and principles governing our democracy and our religious foundation, and because his actions and policies are damaging to our international relationships and negatively impacting not only the lives of our citizens but those of other countries, I find McNaughton's glorification, his hagiographic representation, his idolizing of Trump as dangerous because, among other things, it feeds Trump's colossal egoism and egotism, portending the dark future for this nation and the world, even though McNaughton's vision of America's future is all Trump. He shows Trump as triumphant, riding a motorcycle here. And I conclude by saying, as a Latter-day Saint, I'm both disturbed and offended by McNaughton's deliberate, overt, symbolic, imagistic, and linguistic references to Trump as a Christ figure. In spite of the fact that some evangelicals have anointed Trump as a baby Christian, by which I assume they mean naive and innocent, Trump shows very little evidence of being a Christian. Frankly, given all we know of his dishonesty, misogyny, adultery, cruelty, hypocrisy, and his self-aggrandizement, depicting him as a Christ figure borders on the blasphemous. I am certain McNaughton would be offended by such an assertion, but for someone who takes such trouble to paint, spell out the details of his artistic renderings and their specific particular meaning, and then aggressively marketing them, he cannot escape the judgment of informed critics. McNaughton has painted a lot of truly religious paintings that don't have Trump in them, but the way in which he has associated Trump and Christ seem, I find, both as a Christian and as an art critic, offensive, that one must make a distinction between the kind of art that promotes a political agenda and that which promotes an ideal like that of the Savior and of Christianity. Thank you. If any of you would like the full unredacted copy of this, I'll be happy to send it to you. I now would like to turn the time over to my colleague, Laura Tato.
Do you want to help with tech while I start?
Sure.
Thank you. It's just a PowerPoint. It's right there. Thank you. Robert Reese's paper, John McNaughton, Mormon Artist, Right Wing Propagandist, effectively points to the many maddening issues evident in the works and writing of John McNaughton. First, that he is an ardent propagandist. And second, like the president that he so champions, his rhetoric is absolutist, hypocritical, and heavy-handed, and so lacking in nuance and perspective that it is totalitarian kitsch at its finest. Third, Reese tackles the function of art as a definition, ultimately taking McNaughton to task because of his prescriptive and didactic iconography that spells out everything with such literal and obvious terms that it all ultimately fails to be art, capital A. Lastly, and perhaps most blasphemously, is McNaughton's appropriation of Christian iconography for Trump, which sadly is not unusual or particularly inventive a device for propagandists to draw upon such powerful visual traditions for their own ends and agenda. Trump, as a Republican savior, is depicted without irony and seemingly without any nuance or reflection of the biography of the subject. In other instances, McNaughton, without self-awareness, directly plagiarizes Maynard Dixon's socialist painting, The Forgotten Man, as a tool to fight against American social programs. But to what end does McNaughton matter? What is the ultimate question, and what is ultimately at stake?
Which one's yours? I'm sorry.
It's the other one. This is this one. Okay. Yeah, thank you.
Right, go ahead.
Thank you. If these works are truly believable to an innocent viewer, what does that suggest about McNaughton's power to influence? McNaughton amounts to danger for Reese, danger for the viewer, and danger for our country. Propaganda is effective and a powerful tool, and McNaughton is affecting and powerful propagandist, whose works bespeak to and are symptomatic of a larger culture of nativism, racist rhetoric, hatred of compromise, and fear-mongering that is rampant and pervasive in our country today. That said, propagandists largely speak to an already converted and believing audience. I find it terribly hard to believe that a viewer would stumble upon his works and thus be converted. If he is making money on his works, it is because there is a ripe audience already ready for them. His works are a mirror of ideologies of which he simply regurgitates back as an echo chamber of singular thought. And as such, do his works actually have power, or are they comical, laughable even, and simplistic? Yes to both. Reese successfully and convincingly argues his point, especially when contrasting art to propaganda, but too much time is spent on this belabored comparison and on Reese's opinion of Trump. On the latter, of which I should mention, I feel compelled to mention, I agree with. On the latter, however, it makes an argument succeed only if one sides liberally against the current regime and continues to contribute to polarizing rhetoric. They are wrong, we are right. I don't fault Reese for this, and in my own comments, I struggle to maintain a type of neutrality, but such arguments can create an us versus them of which McNaughton contributes and which Reese does as well. However, what is actually most at stake? And for me, what makes McNaughton most noteworthy, especially within this context of the conference, is his Mormonism, and how his Mormonism is used to justify his conclusions. That is, that he is part of our tribe and that his work reflects upon our community. I want to just switch actually to this final page because it's so wonderful and brilliant. And the artist is here today. This is Matt Page. Matt Page's satirical John McNaughton sketchbook. Matt's right there. Go buy his candles. That is, that he's part of our tribe and that his work reflects upon our community. And on this issue, there is also danger. Danger in our carefully constructed sense of selves and what the works reveal about our theology and belief. I have no interest in writing about the litany of conservative pundits or simply bad artists, but McNaughton requires attention for me, if only for a brief moment, because of his Mormonness. Co-founder and scholar of the Mormon Artist Group and the Center for Latter-day Saint Art, Glenn Nelson, wrote this: "If you self-identify as a Mormon, then the art you're making is Mormon art." as a curator at the Church History Museum, the definition I worked with for Mormon art is art for, by, and about Mormons constituted Mormon art. And under those both definitions, McNaughton, unfortunately, is a Mormon artist. And who would normally be an annoying anomaly in Trumpian America, ignorable, he enters our canon of Mormon art, and us, as such, participates as an equal partner in the dialogue of our history. This is noteworthy because his work is created on absolute moralist terms that draw upon Mormonism for deep and problematic ideological terms. What is troubling about McNaughton is that he, for me, is an embarrassment, and an embarrassment of my view of Mormonism. And even the brand of this conference, the more than one way to Mormon, suggests there is a room for multiplicity of belief, but of course, oh my gosh, not that kind of Mormon, right? Not this kind of Mormon. That's not what we meant, right? McNaughton's work reveals the type of conclusions that one can use Mormonism to arrive at. It exposes the contributions of a problematic racist history justified on religious grounds, a history bought into by our own theology and our own government used to justify continued marginalization, vilification, oppression of a people based on the color of their skin. And I do want to return to this. Scholar Bell Hooks wrote in Black Looks, Race and Representation, from slavery on, white supremacists have recognized that control over images is central to the maintenance of any system of racial dominance. And Patrick Mason, in his review of Paul Reeves' very well-written Race of a Different Color, Religion of a Different Color, Race and Mormon Struggle for Whiteness, wrote, "The church and its members continue to wrestle with the legacy of the perplexing aspects of his racialist policies and the flotilla of race-based theology pronouncements assembled and employed, particularly during the religion's first century and a half. Other than Obama, whiteness prevails supreme in McNaughton's work." Patriarchy is also pervasive in McNaughton's work, as women have just now started to make an appearance, and then mostly as sidekicks to central figures or overly simplistic tropes, the virgin, the mother, and the witch in the case of Nancy Pelosi. McNaughton's paintings also expose the moralist terms that justify a strong political bias that Mormons have towards conservatism, seemingly at all costs. And yet, as The Guardian pointed out recently, Mormon politicians have been some of Donald Trump's most ferocious detractors from the right, as we learn from Mark Twain, in war and in politics, all sides pray for victory. McNaughton is dangerous for me because he uses Mormonism in a way and uses Mormon history in a way I wish to forget and I wish to separate myself from. Within all this framework, as a curator at the Church History Museum, tasked with collecting Mormon art, and now as a director of an institution that specializes in showcasing Utah artists and providing a platform for them, I have had to ask myself, does McNaughton's work matter? Does his mass commercial success and large platform for visibility allow him into our canon? And if so, do we collect him? Do we show him? In my role at the church as a curator, I don't think one can simply ignore McNaughton and make him go away no matter how much we want him to. And so I will confess, I did acquire cheap posters from the BYU bookstore of his Tamer works to be included in a time capsule of Mormon kitsch called the Culture Capsule, in a way of preserving a specific moment in time and what it suggests about Mormonism within that set snapshot. They were stacked among playbills of the Book of Mormon musical, Ponderized t-shirts, sister missionary ornaments, and the funniest thing, like ministering manuals. In an effort to also be complete, I also included the work of another Mormon artist, Matt Page, right next to John McNaughton, whose comical, satirical depiction of John McNaughton's sketchbook mocks the explicit obviousness and simplicity of his work itself. It reads, "What I want to say, Obama is destroying the Constitution." How I could communicate that idea, painting of Obama destroying the Constitution. The funniest part is this note to self. Remember to vote for Obama this November. If he loses, start updating resume. It's just so brilliant and so funny and, just my kind of Mormonism. Differing, however, though, is McNaughton's recent inclusion of a religious painting in the Come Follow Me manual, as well as his distribution store sacrament program templates. They were extremely troubling to me. A record is one thing. Adding him to our visual lexicon in religious and devotional publications is yet another. And his political agenda cannot be divorced and unseen in his religious works. So given this, the church's sense of caution and very careful and extensive efforts taken to be deliberate in their choices, especially when it came to imagery, I felt like it must have been an error made out of ignorance. Multiple calls were made asking the Publishing Services Division, PSD, the one responsible for printing all print and digital materials, to remove all of McNaughton's images from their database, for which they agreed to do, embarrassed at their ignorance. But I cannot verify that he has officially been blotted out. As for the Utah Museum of Contemporary Art, John McNaughton's were also shown there before I came to the museum as the director in an exhibition called Mondo Mormon, the Utah Biennial. And this exhibition was meant to be a snapshot of what art was today in Utah. It was done in about 2012. And both the curator, Aaron Moulton, and McNaughton himself hoped the works hoped the inclusion of the works in the museum, which is branded as liberal and progressive, would cause a stir, would be sensationalized, and would drive audiences. But in reality, the works were dismissed and then quickly ignored. With everything spelled out, frankly, there was nothing to see. Thank you.
You will indulge a few personal references and find them later relevant to the topic. I totally agree with both of our presenters, even though I will make these personal references, time permitting. As a U of U undergraduate, I double majored in both political science and in another art form, theater. Aren't those strange bedfellows? Well, I think that in our time we recognize how close they can be. I was on the debate team at the U my first 2 years, but then I decided that these arbitrary assignments to defend or speak against certain propositions were not a revelation of how we really felt about them, and that these were abstract topics, and that the personal motivation behind those who stood for them, in fact, was more real, as you find it in drama, in say, for example, the plays of Arthur Miller. And that persuaded me to become involved in plays instead of debate. My own first full-length play was produced in my sophomore year at the U, directed by one of the professors. My first 2 years of graduate school were at the Yale School of Drama, and I have been involved in writing plays and having my students, even in Russian literature classes, perform scenes to be more directly in contact with the characters they've been reading about in Dostoevsky and Tolstoy, for example. My later scholarship focused on dissident Soviet writers like Pasternak and Solzhenitsyn. My dissertation was published by the prominent Slavic publisher in The Hague, Mouton, and my last study, entitled Myth and Symbol in Soviet Fiction, by the Mellon Research University Press. These writers that I was so intrigued by, these dissident Soviet writers, a number of whom were exterminated in the Gulag, but managed to publish during the Soviet Union, were polemically anti-Stalinist, with which I believe not anyone here would have disagreed, even so-called socialist Democrats. A similar grievance was expressed in the marvelous music of Dmitri Shostakovich, his glorious tragic symphonies and chamber music, to refer to another art form, and to the heartfelt melancholy of Alexander Scriabin. Interestingly, his uncle was Stalin's foreign minister, Vyacheslav Molotov, who took as his pseudonym the name Molotov from the Russian word for hammer, just as Stalin himself, whose real name is Yosif Vissarionovich Chugashvili, a Georgian name, took the name Stalin from the word in Russian, steel. And in fact, Lenin, their forerunner, whose real name is Vladimir Ulyanov, and who took the pseudonym Lenin from the longest river in the world in Siberia, and therefore presumably the greatest, the Lena. This is not quite anything to do with art per se, I guess. In turn, McNaughton may well view Trump's surname as emblematic of the Second Coming, as described in the Book of Revelations. During our 3 years in St. Petersburg, immediately after the fall of the Iron Curtain, on two separate years, I saw the memorable retrospective exhibit at what is called in St. Petersburg the Russian Museum, which if you ever have been there on a cruise, you will not be brought to. You will be taken to the Hermitage instead, former Winter Palace, where there is not one single piece of Russian art. It was all taken by Catherine from the West. But in the Russian Museum, you see the great paintings of particularly the 19th century Russian painters. And those two exhibits, they were called Agitatsiya za Shastya, Agitation for Happiness, and they were a retrospective on the Soviet period and its socialist realist art. You had the hors d'oeuvres that were sold there from back then, with patriotic Soviet hymns wafting over the intercom, and everywhere you turned, immense canvases showing crowds of happy, cheering farmers, athletes, or even members of the Supreme Soviet and delegates to one of the party congresses, annual party congresses. And in each one of them, a spotlight hits on one figure in particular, alone, all dressed in white. Who do you think? Stalin. Reminiscent of the photos we have seen of our first presidency after the dedication of a temple outside of it, all in white. or as Bob showed us, in Goya's painting as well, the Savior figure there, his shirt. So those are interesting parallels. One more minute. And there are a couple more showing Lenin. These are common paintings in the Soviet period. They were stolen from Western Christian art, showing him with happy children sitting on Lenin's lap, which never occurred, of course, or walking along the Neva River in Leningrad, calling forth his apostles. I later made a slide presentation of this symbolism, appropriation of it by Soviet art for the Utah Academy. McNaughton's work is no more subtle. I'd just like to conclude then by saying that since reading Bob's essay here, my credo has become, whether visual, tonal, or literary, all genuine and meaningful art is never didactic or polemical. It addresses perennial human concerns that are ambiguous, full of conflict, often subconscious, while not taking sides. While celebrating the awesome mysteries of nature or of human personality, genuine art seizes the viewer, sensitizes the viewer, listener, or reader to identify and empathize with those who are less fortunate and oppressed. Hence the title of my 1981 BYU Forum address, The Sacred in Literature. And anything less than that is, as the phrase goes these days, fake art. And may I just conclude with this other personal reference. The first of my plays, produced at BYU, Huebner, premiered in 1974. None of us could foresee what a happening it was, not just another play. It renewed my playwriting avocation and led to a total of 29 authored plays. After its flowing reviews, including in the Deseret News, glowing it should be, I received 10 requests from other theaters, including several from out of state, to mount future productions of Huebner. The story of how it was banned by two apostles in Salt Lake is well known. After the then BYU President Oakes gently informed us of the request from Salt Lake that we desist from having that play produced again, I said to him, before you and the BYU administration condemn this play, please come and see it yourselves. President Oakes did much better. He invited one of those two apostles to come see it with him, which he did. I was not present, but was told that he was complimentary to the cast and to the director. President Oakes himself later told me that while walking the apostle from the Fine Arts Building to his car, he had asked him, "Don't you think this play addresses issues we should be thinking about?" The answer, yes, but Helmut Huebner was never a Joseph Smith. The apostle's response still dumbfounds me, but in its spirit I now declare that Donald Trump is no Jesus Christ. To even imagine or imply as much is utter blasphemy, pure and simple. I'm sorry we don't have time for some of your comments. Thank you.
Sadly, our time is up, but we will be out there if some of you want to talk. I had begun this presentation with a quotation from Wallace Stevens. The function of art, as well as religion, is the revelation of something wholly other, W-H-O-L-L-Y, but it also could be H-O-L-Y, revelation of something wholly other by which the inexpressible loneliness of thinking is broken and enriched. That's what great art is for. That's what great art does, whether it's the wonderful paintings or dramas of Tom or the art that Laura's curating of the art that our artists really produce, which is to give us an opportunity ourselves to see ourselves however we want to see ourselves and the world in what they produce. Thank you so much for coming to this session. And as I say, we'll be out in the foyer if anyone wants to talk about any of the things we've talked about today. Thank you so much.